Aristotle, Apprehension, Predication, and Deduction. Now, this is the introduction to Thomistic epistemology, to understand what Aquinas means and all the terms that Aquinas uses. You must understand Aristotle because of the terminology. And if you're not familiar with these terms, they can really throw you a curve. To understand Aquinas, you have to understand the three acts of the intellect. The first act of the intellect is apprehension, the second act is predication, and the third act is deduction. Apprehension means the understanding of a thing, object, etc. Apprehension involves the following things. The subject of apprehension, a rational animal, by the first act of the intellect. The object of apprehension is an essence or a form of a thing. The method of apprehension is abstraction of the universal from the particulars. Example, you look at five or six particular human beings, and you abstract what they all have in common, and you get their essence. You see, one is short and one is tall. That's not part of their essence. You see, they're all rational. That's part of their essence. And so by abstraction, you're able to come to the essence of something by looking at various particulars. Get to that in detail a little more later. Then fourthly, there are the modes of apprehension. These are called the predicaments. The predicaments are not to be confused with the predicables, which we'll get to later. This will be worse than, what was the guy in chapel the other day, the tertiary Byzantine contribution to the... The predicaments are the categories. According to Aristotle, there is substance and nine accidents. So the first category is substance. That's what something is. Subject of apprehension, which he distinguishes into two categories: primary substance, the ultimate subject of all predications, namely an individual, or secondary substance, the predicable of everything in a class or universal. But besides substance, what something is, you can talk about that thing in nine different ways, according to quantity, quality, relation, action, passion, place, time, position, or habit. You can ask this question about any substance or subject. How much, that's quantity, of the subject is being apprehended? Or you can ask the quality question about a subject or individual. What kind of subject is apprehended? You might want to know the relation of that subject. To what does the subject have reference? Or you might want to know the action. On what is the subject acting? Paul is throwing a ball on the wall. The passion, from what is it receiving the action? The ball is bouncing back to him. The place, where is the subject apprehended to be? In the backyard, say. When? 5 o'clock in the afternoon, that's time. Position, under what circumstances is the subject apprehended? What are the conditions surrounding this? Or 10, which is the ninth accident or category. The habit or state, in what condition is the subject apprehended to be? Now, this is a special category. Habit is natural, but not essential to a thing. By habit, he means clothes to a man or shodding to a horse. It's natural for humans to have clothes, but not essential. You're still human when you're naked. It's natural to shod a horse, but it's not essential. You're still a horse when you're not shod. According to Aristotle, and Aquinas follows this, there are then these 10 modes of apprehension. You can think about, apprehend, get in your mind any individual or substance in 10 different categories. You can think about its substance, its whatness, or you can ask how much, what kind, to what, on what, from what, where, when, under what circumstances, or in what condition do you find it. That's the first act of the intellect, called understanding or apprehension. Now, you can apply this to a stone. You can apply this to a vegetable, a stone, a human being. We're not talking about an individual necessarily as a rational individual. He thinks that here are the categories of thought. For Aristotle, if he were a Kantian, he would say, you're born with these categories. This is how you just think about everything. Everybody has 10 categories. You reduce. How did he get them? By a transcendental reduction. Kant were around. You just look at everything that's going on. This is what makes Aristotle so brilliant. When you think, he's the first guy to make this list. All he did is think and reflect and observe, and he reduced all of the ways that you can think about something to 10. Only 10 basic ways. You can think about its whatness. You can think about its how muchness, its what kindness, its to whatness, its on whatness, its from whatness, its whereness, its whenness, its under what circumstanceness, and in what conditionness. That's first act of the intellect. The mind has the ability to do that. Second act of the intellect, the mind is called predication. That is a declaration or assertion about a thing, object, etc. And here, we have to talk about the subject of predication, and the subject of predication, the only thing that can make predications, judgments, connect predicates and subjects. And you all know what I mean when I say connect predicates and subjects. I'm talking logically. I'm talking about S is P. S is P, or the tree is green. Logically, green is a predicate. Tree is the subject, and the is the connective, called the copula. So the only kind of being that can make predications of a subject are rational beings. Tree is green. Mary is kind. The subject of predication is a rational animal. That's how he defines man, Aristotle, a rational animal. By the second act of the intellect can apprehend things, and it can make predications. The object of predication is an essence, form, or quiddity. That may be a new term to you. Quiddity just means an essence as related to a mind. And you might want to do this. Quiddity, nature, essence, and substance all refer to the same thing. Ontologically, there's no difference in these terms. Quiddity is, let's call it the whatness. These all have to do with whatness. A quiddity is whatness related to a mind. Nature is whatness related to operations or activity. Essence is whatness related to existence. And substance is usually whatness related to accidents, or as opposed to accidents. That is, substance is what you are essentially, and accidents are what you have accidentally. So substance, if you were talking about whatness related to accidents, you'd call it a substance. If you're talking about whatness related to existence, you would call it essence. If you're talking about whatness related to the activity of something, you'd call it a nature. If you're talking about whatness related to a mind, you'd call it a quiddity. Part of the language game they play. That's the Aristotelian Thomistic language game. Those are the words. However, they have that same heritage in Western thought and are still used that way roughly today, although they're used more interchangeably. Okay, back to Roman numeral 2. Predication then is a declaration or assertion about a thing, an object. The subject of predication is a rational man. The object is an essence, form, or quiddity. And the purpose of a predication is to define the nature of a thing. That's the purpose for making a judgment about it, to get at what it is, define its nature. The predicables, the modes of predication, according to Aristotle, that is the ways a predicate may be predicated of a subject. You can predicate according to the genus when the predicate gives you the characteristic common to many. So if we were defining man, and you predicated man according to his genus, that which is common to many, man belongs to this same class, you would say man is an animal, because he belongs to the class of animals. According to Aristotle, and Aquinas would agree. If you use the predication rational, you are predicating according to the specific difference man has from the other animals. Man is a rational animal, and there are no other rational animals. When the predicate gives the characteristic distinctive of it, So if you said man is rational, you would be predicating according to specific difference. If you said man is animal, you'd be predicating according to genus. If you said man is a rational animal, then you would be predicating according to the species, because that's the very definition of man. He is a rational animal. And the predicate gives both, namely the whole definition, both the genus and the specific difference together, equals the species, or the very definition. If you said man has risibility, you would be predicating of man according to a property. And a property is when the predicate gives what flows from the essence but isn't part of the essence. Now, risibility means the ability to laugh. And if you said man has risibility, or man is risible, you're not giving his essence. He's not essentially a laughing being. But it's not accidental to man either. It's not just an accident. It's something that flows from his essence. If you're a rational being, you can be a humorous being, because only laughing hyenas notwithstanding, only rational beings can laugh. Because if you don't have a sense of the incongruity, see, the basis of all laughter is a sense of the incongruous. Incongruous is where the congressmen spend all their time. See, we all have a sense of risibility here, just proving the point. So if you give risibility, you are saying man is a rational being because flowing from that rationality is his ability to laugh. It's not accidental to him that he can laugh, and it's not essential to man that he can laugh. It's a property, and property flows from the essence, but is not part of the essence. It's not accidental to the essence. A property is halfway between an accident. An accident is you're tall, or you're white, or you're black, or you're red. That's color is accidental to your humanness. Tallness is accidental to your humanness. But rationality is not accidental. That's essential to your humanness. Risibility is a property that flows from your essence, but is not your essence, nor is it an accident. If you say man is white, you are making a predication according to accidents. That's accidental to a human, what color they are. When a predicate gives what inheres in the essence, but is not part of the essence. Because the essence of man is a rational animal, and white, red and yellow, black and white, simply accidental. Now, that happens to deal with the modes of predication, or the predicables, five different modes of, or ways of saying a predicate about a subject. The next is quantity and quality under predication. Quantity or extent of predication, every proposition is either universal or particular. A universal proposition means all in its class. All men are rational. Anything less than all is particular, and it's generally designated as some. Some men are fat. So that a universal proposition would cover all in its class, a particular proposition would cover less than all. Even if it happened to be most, many, or some, it's still less than all. Then you can make predication according to quality, and that would be either affirmative or negative. You're either affirming something, all men are rational, or all men are not irrational. You're affirming or denying. So the quality of your predication has to do with whether it's affirmative or negative, the quantity, whether it's universal or particular, and the mode, whether it's giving the genus as animal, specific difference as rational, species as rational animal, property as risibility, or accidents as white. That's the second act of the intellect. The first act of the intellect is apprehension. Second act is predication in the modes we just discussed. The third act of the intellect is has to do with syllogisms, where we make valid deductions or inferences about things. There's deductive logic, inductive logic, and fallacious logic, and Aristotle writes on all of these. Deductive logic, formal logic, deals with validity. It deals with deductions, and this is called prior analytics. Aristotle wrote a book on prior analytics, and Aquinas wrote a commentary on Aristotle's prior analytics. Material logic deals with truth, not just validity. See, even stupid syllogisms can be valid. I mean, if all men are purple, and John is a man, then John is purple. That's valid. That follows validly from those premises, even though it's false. So validity has only to do with the formal inference. Granted, the premises are true, the conclusion follows validly and would be true, but if the premises are false, the conclusion just follows validly, but it could be false. So formal logic deals with validity. Material logic deals with truth. This deals with actual demonstrations. Give me a couple of true premises, like all men are rational. Socrates is a man. I can give you a true conclusion. Socrates is rational. That's posterior analytics of Aristotle and Aquinas' commentary on it. Then there's another kind of logic called inductive logic that deals with opinions. Now, the word opinion in the ancient world was stronger than it is today. It meant probable reasoning rather than demonstrable reasoning. If all men are rational and Socrates is a man, then that's demonstrable reasoning that Socrates is rational. That's proven. But inductive logic, where you're making observation and extrapolations and probabilities, is called opinion. Deals with probable reasoning, induction, and that's called the topics, Aristotle's book, The Topics. The third kind, fallacious logic, invalid and false, deals with incorrect reasoning, called sophistical refutations by Aristotle and Aquinas. And these books still stand as classics in the field, and in spite of the fact they're written 400 B.C., and they're going on 2,400 years old, they're still the classics in the field, written by Aristotle, and he's the first to ever put this together. That's why I have almost a sense of awe for a mind like Aristotle's. And when the guy was the first to do it, he wrote the books, and they still stand as the classics in the field, never really been surpassed by, added to and modified by others, but never been surpassed since. That's a great intellectual giant. Aquinas took this material, and he wrote commentaries on it. Now, Aquinas' own epistemology, to which we turn now, basically took Aristotle's categories, Aristotle's logic, and he put his own particular Christian understanding to this, and we'd like to discuss that in some detail. The sources for Thomistic epistemology, the primary sources are his commentary on Aristotle's De Anima, about the soul, the commentary in Aristotle's Posterior Analytics, commentary in Aristotle's On Interpretation, one of the great books on hermeneutics ever written, which really saved the Reformation, incidentally, when Luther decided not to go allegorical Platonic, but to go Aristotelian and save the Reformation. Aquinas's book Summa Theologica, especially 116, 158, and 177 through 79, and 187, and then Aquinas on Truth, 814 and 10.8, would be some good primary sources for Thomistic epistemology. Some good secondary sources, Brennan, R.E. Brennan's book Thomistic Psychology, that's the old classic called the Essentialist View, which we'll talk more about later as opposed to the existential interpretation of Aquinas. One of the best, in my opinion, is Regis, R-E-G-I-S, Epistemology. Good systematic treatise based on the text from Aquinas. He's actually interpreting text. He'll give you his text and interpret them. He's trying to be faithful to Aquinas. Jacques Maritain is probably the most popular book and the most readable. And if you want something exciting and readable and up-to-date and Thomistic, you just get the flavor from reading any of Maritain's books. This one's called The Degrees of Knowledge, a Neo-Thomistic Existential View of Aquinas, in which he stresses that Aquinas believed that existence was prior to essence, which is the heart of existentialism, and he claims that Aquinas was the first modern existentialist, and the Neo-Thomists are distinguished by this existential interpretation of Aquinas. We'll have more to say about that when we deal with his metaphysics. Then Willemsen, who teaches over here at the University of Dallas, F.D. Willemsen, Man's Knowledge of Reality. He stresses critical realism and the role of the judgment, the second act of the intellect. And there are two things about post-Kantian Thomists. Post-Kantian Thomists went from a more basic realism that man can know the real world to what's called a critical realism, where they had to defend that because Kant had built this gulf, said you can't know the real world. Then after Kant, the Thomists say, well, you can, and here's how you do, and they become more defensive and more critical in their view than they were before Kant. And then Van Wright, Thomistic Epistemology, a historical study of Thomistic epistemology. That's probably the classic historical work on the topic. So there are some sources, primary and secondary. Let's take a look at the Thomistic theory of knowledge itself. It can be divided into powers of sensation, powers of intellection, the object of intellection, and the nature of knowledge, and the process of knowing. Those are the main points we want to talk about. Let's talk about, first of all, the powers of sensation. Aquinas believes that everything that's in the mind first began in the senses, except the mind itself. The power of sensation, a power equals an accident or property of man, not his essence. A power is more like a property, it's more like risibility. It's either a very important accident or a power. And man has the power of sensation. The first power is he has the power to receive images. There's a tree out there, and I have the power to have an image of a tree in my mind. So the power to receive images from a single object. The five single senses are sight, smell, touch, hearing, and taste. And each one has a proper object. The proper object of sight is color, so you have the ability to receive color. You also have the ability to receive odor. That's the proper object of the sense smell. You also have the power to touch, which is called the tactile power. This is the power that enables you to sense something that you're touching. The power of hearing, the proper object is sound, and the power of taste, the proper object is flavor. So your outer senses, called impressed species, receive this material, and they transmit it to your brain where it's stored, which are the inner senses, and we'll talk about that later, about the expressed species. So the impressed species are these outer objects. Think of something as purple out there, and that is impressing itself on you, and you have the power to receive it and transmit it to your brain where it can be stored and used for later image making. The second power you have is the power to recognize objects and coordinate them. If you only had the power of sight or smell or touch or hearing or taste, and they were uncoordinated, you might smell something and see something but not know it was the same thing. But you have some sort of power to coordinate so that when I look at this red book and I feel it, and I see it, I know that I'm seeing and feeling one and the same object. That power is called common sense by Aquinas, but it's so different from what we mean by common sense. It just means a unifying sense, an ability to unify what all your senses are bringing to you and recognize it as one and the same object. So it recognizes objects and coordinates them. Common sense, unifying ability. And this deals with movement, rest, number, shape, and size. All of those things, movement involves at least two or more senses. Shape involves two or more senses, size, number, and rest. And in order to do that, you have to have this common or unifying ability. That would tend to support the theory that there was some sort of unifying sense then.
That was what there wasn't.
That there wasn't?
Yes.
Why? To support that there wasn't, you would have to show that he could do it from one sense. You'd have to show that he could do it from only one. Because a unifying sense means that
you need some sort of power in order to unify these two or more senses that are bringing you data about one and the same thing. I don't know anything about that experiment, and I'm not saying this is true right here, that this is that everything Aquinas says is true on this. I'm just expounding it. But what I would say that they would have to do experimentally is they would have to show, to disprove this aspect of his theory, they would have to show that you could do these things from one sense alone, and that you don't need two or more senses in order to do it.
Well, the thing is, if I see something that looks rough, I know from experience that if I touch it, it'll feel.
But how do you know that that's one and the same thing? How do you know that, say, I'm feeling the sharp edge of this desk, and I see it, and it looks pretty sharp? How do I know that that's one and the same thing? I'm getting, my sight is seeing it and my finger is feeling it. How do I know it's one and the same thing? How do I know I'm not feeling something else unless I have some unifying sense to bring that together?
Well, the theorists would say that things that look like that have always felt like that.
How do they know that?
There's a relationship between them.
Yeah, but
common sense people would say that there's something about the look of sharp and the feel of sharp that is one. Whereas the theorists would say that.
Well, you did learn it. You know, you learned it by feeling, and you look at it, and it's got a pretty sharp angle there, you know, and it comes together, and it's not rounded at the corner. You do see that. But then you feel that. But something has to put those two together, that you're feeling and seeing one and the same thing. Because otherwise you could be feeling something else. You might be feeling something round, actually, and seeing something pointed. I mean, it just seems, I hate to use the word, common sense to me, that there is such a thing as a common sense. It just seems common sense that you would have to, because you're getting all these perceptions. Think of getting five different senses of the same thing. Think of smelling it, seeing it, hearing it, everything. Now, how do you know that there's an it there? And that what you smell, see, hear, taste, put it all in there, is one and the same thing. Somehow or other, when these perceptions are coming to you, something is coordinating them. That power, Aquinas calls common sense, unifying sense. That's all we want to do for now. I don't really care to carry that one any farther than that. It's not really that important. Thirdly, you have the ability to retain these images. You can receive an image, color, odor, tactile, sound, flavor. You can recognize objects and coordinate them, and you can retain these, and the ability to retain them is called imagination. Imagination is not the same as memory. Imagination is simply the ability to retain and store these images. I see a tree. I close my eyes, and I still see that tree. So I must have stored it. I see a red book. Close my eyes. I still see a red book. I stored it. Now, the next power that you have, besides receiving, recognizing, retaining, is the ability to recall what you stored. And as you know, that's a little different power because of final exams that have proven that to you over and over. It's a whole lot easier to store than it is to recall. And your passive knowledge is greater than your active knowledge, and your passive vocabulary is greater than your active vocabulary for this same reason. Retaining is one thing, recalling is another thing. I believe I retain about everything I ever read, but I don't recall everything I ever read. As somebody said, I have a photographic memory. It's overexposed and underdeveloped. So Aquinas would agree with that bit of risibility there that just shared. Retain these images as imagination. Recalling them is memory. Then you have the ability to relate these images to ends. This is called the cogitative ability. The cogitative or estimative. And Aquinas thinks that instinct fits in this category. That a dog, for example, just animal, by virtue of being an animal, a man has certain instinctive things that he shares with other animals, the ability to relate certain things to certain ends, food and hunger, water and thirst. If you weren't able to do that, you'd die of thirst or die of hunger. If you weren't able to relate that need to that end and to go for it and try and get it, you wouldn't be able to survive. So we have the powers of sensation, which are five. Receive the image, recognize the image, retain it, recall it, and relate it. Or the single objects of sense, coordinate common sense, imagination, memory, and the cogitative or estimative abilities. Now the next thing we want to talk about is the power of intellection. That's simply the power to sense. Now when the mind gets all this stuff that you bring to it by your senses, the mind goes to work, and the first power is the power to represent the object without its material condition. Now, I'm looking at this green tree out the window.